This is Red Ice Radio. From the visible to the obscure. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome to Red Ice Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for tuning in today. You can follow us on RedIceCreations.com. Regular news updates, radio, TV, and much more. James Corbett is an independent journalist who has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He has been writing and producing The Corbett Report, an online multimedia news and information source, since 2007. He's also behind the websites FukushimaUpdate.com and ClimateGate.tv. Today he returns to Red Ice Radio to give us an update on the Fukushima disaster in the first hour. And in the second, we focus on ClimateGate 2.0. Stay with us for much more. Welcome back, James. It's excellent to talk to you once more. We had you, of course, with us back in January on the 21st, if my memory is correct, and it's good to talk to you again. We have so many issues that have unfolded since that time, and we're going to try to go into them one at a time here today. But first of all, of course, welcome back, James. How are you, and how have you been, of course?
Well, I think I'm doing fairly well considering all of the things that have gone on. But as you say, it's been an extremely eventful year, especially for us here in Japan. So thank you for taking the time to have me on the program today.
You bet. How has things changed, if we can begin with that question, in Japan? And also, if you don't mind letting us know, James, are you anywhere near Fukushima, or are you in, you know, direct danger, as it were? Because I want to try to detail this with you in terms of how bad things are, obviously, and how close you are as well.
Right. Well, I'm about 700 kilometers to the southwest of Fukushima here in the western part of the main island of Japan. So that's about 400 miles southwest for the American listeners in the audience. And that's a fairly large distance when it comes to the actual fallout itself, although because of the prevailing winds, which tended to take a lot of the fallout to the east, the western part of Japan was, in some areas, not so affected. And with some of the recent maps that have come out of the fallout, it shows that our area of Japan was, for the most part, spared from the direct fallout from the initial few months when it was just sort of belching out the radiation out into the atmosphere. But I think for myself personally, and I think for most people in Japan, the main concern at this point is, well, firstly, the food supply, which unfortunately has become tainted because of this scandal. And then also the main issue, of course, being the very, 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 very on a nice edge, basically close to coming to a China syndrome, which was something that really we didn't really learn the details of until months and months and months after it actually occurred, even though they knew within hours, and if not at the very least within days, that there had been complete meltdowns at the plant and that it had eaten through the primary containment. But we weren't told about that for many months afterwards. So it's been, as I say, an incredible year. But myself personally and my wife here and my friends, I think we're mostly concerned about the food issue at this point. And obviously, if any nuclear fuel were to get into the groundwater, that would be something of basically unthinkable proportions and would make, unfortunately, would likely make Japan a very uninhabitable wasteland, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
If that were to come to it.
There's so much to this that I want to try to get to. But first of all, then, have things progressed pretty much as normal where you are, or have you seen things change, people losing their jobs, etc.? What's happening on that level?
I think I've been surprised for the most part by how little this has directly affected day-to-day life here, at least in this part of Japan. Certainly towards Tokyo, I know that in the earlier part of the year they were having blackouts and energy, rolling energy blackouts and shutdowns because of the effect to the power grid, or at least that's what we were being told at the time, although I think it turned out that eventually they've just concluded that the energy that was lost from the Fukushima plant actually they're able to more than meet that supply through other means. So actually that whole drama perhaps was more of a psychological operation than anything. but yeah, certainly there was a lot of that, and there was a lot of press regarding the tsunami disaster and the victims, of course, and all of the aid that was sent and things of that nature. But in terms of the day-to-day life here on the western part of Japan, at any rate, it seems to have affected very little. And even in terms of the overall economy, it's difficult for me to say, but I haven't seen large-scale effects in terms of industrial manufacturing or anything, at least on this part of the island. Of course, the tsunami devastated much of the eastern part and radiated a lot of the supplies that are coming from there to the point where some countries have even stopped accepting Japanese cars because they were coming shipped with radiation, basically radiated hulks. So it has affected Japan in many ways, but it's difficult to say on a day-to-day basis. And one of the most surprising things to me was the fact that very few people even actually discuss it, or it's not really a talking point for a lot of people here, and that might just be part of Japanese society not talking about politics or things of, you know, potentially sensitive matters in mixed company. But again, that was pretty surprising for me as well.
What's your stance on the earthquake, by the way, that later led to the tsunami? Foul play, normal geological activity? What do you think?
I can't rule out the possibility of foul play, but I don't know if the evidence is there for me to be able to say conclusively that it was or it wasn't or what happened precisely. We do know that there was, and this has been shown, that there was some atmospheric effects going on before and after the earthquake. So clearly there is an effect there, but is that a result of HARP or HARP-like technologies, as has been asserted? Don't think I'm in a position to say at this point. And I'm not sure. I don't want to say conclusively either way, because I don't think I'm in a position to say that. But certainly, we know that those types of technologies exist, and that they certainly can be used to create and modify weather patterns and things of that nature. But I see a tendency in the wake of every large-scale natural disaster now to immediately blame HARP, and I think that might be in and of itself something that might be a detriment to the research that goes on in this area, because it raises to my mind the question of, well, do large-scale natural disasters happen? And if they do, then what criteria do we use to determine whether or not it was man-made? And I just don't think the standards for the research are there in a lot of ways at this point.
Yeah, well said. Almost 300 days ago now then, since the disaster, if we can call it that, what is going on? How bad do you think it's going to get? And furthermore, as an extension to that, who can we trust to tell us the right story here? Because there is conflicting information from all accounts, it seems, and some people are managing to dig up some sensitive information, while obviously TEPCO has a different stance on this. What's your approach? How have you been able to dissect some of the information that's coming out?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's one that a lot of people obviously have in the wake of any large-scale disaster, let alone one with ramifications that are potentially as serious as this one. But I think perhaps it's predicated on the wrong idea entirely, that we have to look for a source of information that we can trust per se. And the more I look into things just generally around the world, I think the less trust I have in really anything, even the alternative media. The mainstream media obviously works for its own corporate and foundation-funded masters. So I think it has its own agenda, and that's been quite obvious, and it's quite easy to point that out. But even the alternative media, I think, can take stories and run with them and not do the proper research that's required. So I don't think I do trust any particular side on when it comes to any issue. I think the only thing that I can say for people out there who are looking for trustworthy sources of information is that they have to look in the mirror and take that responsibility on themselves, especially when we live in this age where literally we have access to news reports from all around the world at our fingertips. I mean, it's amazing the technological world we're living in. And with that, I think, comes the responsibility and the burden, and it is a burden, but it's one that we have to take up for ourselves to basically become our own editors and decide what stories to take and what stories to discard and why we should do so. So I'm not here to really tell anyone that they should listen to me or to anyone else in particular. I'm just someone who's doing my level best to try to cut through a lot of the propaganda that's going on, I think, on both sides of every issue, both from the mainstream and the alternative perspective. And the Fukushima disaster, I think, is really no different, because it seems to me that the reports that get played up the most are either the ones that come out on the mainstream side, absolutely downplaying everything that happened there and saying that nuclear power is wonderful and vindicated because of this. And then on the other side, there's the exact opposite, which are the people who are saying that this is the worst disaster that's ever happened in the history of the Earth and that everyone's going to be dead in a few years.
Right.
And I think both of those sides overstate and or understate the issue, but it's really a mirror image to me. And I think that the truth probably lies somewhere more in the middle. And I that's kind of what I'm looking for. So on my website where I'm covering this, FukushimaUpdate.com, I am trying to give space to both sides of that argument so people can decide for themselves. And ultimately, that's where it comes down to people taking responsibility for this information and what they choose to allow into their mind or choose to discard.
Excellent. What do you make of some of the reports coming out, though? Do you think these can be trusted? Understandably, there is a difference between an editorial piece, if you will, or an opinion piece in an online paper or a regular paper, TV report, what have you. But if you have a straight reporting, but let's say this is being quoted from official TEPCO sources, what have you, then we're in the realm of this being very, very difficult both to verify and to trust, of course, because of the track record that has been shown TEPCO having, at least in terms of them downplaying this to the point of absurdity. What do you say about that, James?
Well, that's exactly right. And I think my earlier point wasn't to say that these types of issues are ultimately undecidable. I think that we can come to some at least fairly informed decisions when we're deciding what reports to take on board or what reports to dismiss. And I think you're right. It would be along the lines of looking at the sources of the information and trying to decide what their track record is. So as you point out, obviously TEPCO has been absolutely atrocious in getting information out to the public in the wake of this disaster and has been proven time and time again to have been covering up what they knew and when they knew it and what actions they were taking and what effect they had. And that's been proven in spades over the last several months. But just as a case in point, just earlier this week, actually, there was a new report published from the Nuclear Industrial and Safety Agency here in Japan, which is the National Nuclear Regulator. And they published a 507-page report, which really does excoriate the TEPCO and the response of the government really in a lot of ways. But one would, again, have to take that with a grain of salt because it shows that the NISA, the nuclear regulator here, is I think, trying to bone up its credentials and try to make itself look like more of a trustworthy source of information, that it doesn't have a dog in this fight. But I think it's been proven over the last several months and years, really, since there's been previous accidents at Tokaimura, for example, in also involving TEPCO, that the NISA has been in bed with the nuclear industry here in Japan for a long time. And as Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds.com has been pointing out for a long time, that is absolutely no different in the U.S. nuclear industry that he's been working in or had been working in for several decades. It's the exact same thing, and that's almost to be expected with the nuclear regulators being in the back pocket of industry. And again, of course, that's not just in the nuclear industry. That's in a number of different industries. But it goes to show that when we have these big reports, that even the ones that seem to come out on the side of reason, there are cynical motivations behind that. But again, I trust that most people will be able to see through things like that and understand, Even when the information itself is correct, that there may be other ulterior political motives for releasing this information at this time when it might have less of an effect than it would have, for example, if this information had been released within, say, 1 month of the disaster.
Japan has been hit hard in the past, as we know, historically, looking at the country. And I go back to an article that I since have been actually struggling to find online. It was a CFR report that came out shortly after the disaster happened, and I know that they were talking about how closed off Japanese society was. They talked about how this would be an opportunity for them, for CFR and for the other ilks, if you will, in the geopolitical sphere, to begin to reform Japanese society, to increase immigration and kind of open up the society more. They've been fairly closed off, and I couldn't help to make the connection at this point. It doesn't necessarily mean that the globalists, the New World Order, is behind the earthquake, as we touched upon before, but it definitely means that they are there like vultures as soon as something happens, and that they use catastrophe, they use disasters to, you know, in a political sense and for their own purposes, to get their own, you know, agenda across, basically. Did you ever come across that report? And furthermore, maybe you can comment on if you think that Japanese society is going to change because of this disaster, James.
Well, we certainly do know that that order out of chaos is the motto of the way that the New World Order operates. We know that it's the sine qua non of what they do, and really their existence is predicated on creating the disasters that then they can use, or at least exploiting the disasters, as you point out, to then use them to reshape societies in a number of ways. And we see that in all sorts of different different aspects of the global society that they're attempting to shape right now. And of course, you would know in Europe with the ongoing Eurozone crisis and all of that that's happening over there. Certainly, just some incredible things that are coming about. And as the former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel put it, this is a crisis, but it's also a great opportunity and a time to go ahead with the agenda. So this is an old concept that's been used for centuries at least to reshape societies. It remains, in my mind, it remains to be seen how or in what way this crisis is going to be used to reshape Japanese society. And could it be the start of the opening of the door of Japanese society to more outside influence and intervention in what's been a remarkably closed and inward-looking society for thousands of years now, really? Could it be? It certainly could be. I don't really see the straightforward way that it's going to get from here to there at this point, because, as I say, it still hasn't really filtered down to the level of my day-to-day life here in the western part of Japan at any rate. And as I say, it's quite different, I think, for people in the eastern part of the main island. But whether this can be used or will be exploited, I'm sure it will be. But in what way, I'm not sure. I, at this point, again, I think it's just really too early to say. And even in terms of the globalist agenda, I mean, this still gives a black eye to the nuclear industry in general, which has is such an integral part of the military industrial system, of course, and with a lot of the entire nuclear energy industry having grown up around the nuclear weapons program, which is why, for example, uranium is used as the core ingredient, because obviously the byproducts can be weaponized and things of that sort. So I'm not sure this does work in favor of their agenda in some ways. I'm sure it does in other ways. But again, I think we're a little bit too much in the midst of the cloud to see the dust settling at this point. But certainly I take the general point that this can be used to shape society. I just don't know exactly at this point which way it will be used.
I think you're right. I think the strategy here is long term, as always, and we're looking at this in short term, in the intermediary, how they might be playing the pawns, if you will, but who knows how they will use this disaster in the future and how that will come. But I wanted to address this report also that came out, and I saw that you linked it up. I did the same a while back, about 14,000 U.S. deaths possibly being tied to the Fukushima reactor disaster, because we've had a lot of fallout allegedly coming over, you know, your home country, Canada, and also over in the United States. Of course, the majority of the wind has been blowing towards North America. How bad do you think it is, James, when a report like this comes out? I mean, this will be debated for years to come. As same thing with Chernobyl. You know, we've had this now, this issue never really settling, actually, and we don't know how much of the increasing in cancers and so forth we should attribute to this, or if it's from other sources. What do you think? What do you make of it?
It is a startling headline. It is a startling idea that 14,000 deaths have occurred, and that within the first 14 weeks of the meltdown, let alone the months since then. So it is absolutely a shocking figure. And I'm going to confess I haven't yet read the entire study. I've only read the write up about it. But from what I've read, this is based on excess deaths and looking and trying to scry the tea leaves in some ways from excess deaths and right. How many can be attributed to Fukushima. And as you say, this is something that will never be ultimately decidable. We will never be able to put our finger on some, you know, magic equation that's going to say that these cancers or these deaths are directly related to Fukushima, which is really, of course, the mask that the nuclear industry will hide behind in the wake of any disaster, as they did in Chernobyl, to say, oh, well, Chernobyl has only resulted in 54 deaths or whatever the official number is, when, of course, we know that to be ridiculous. But then we have the other estimates, which show as much as a million deaths as a result of Chernobyl. And again, that is a startling figure. But when you really start to look into how it was found out, I mean, ultimately it is guesswork and patchwork and best estimates and things of that nature. So I do understand that this is, again, just because it may be ultimately undecidable doesn't mean that it's not worth looking into. It certainly is, and we should be keeping our mind on it. But ultimately, my gut reaction to this is to say that 14,000 deaths in 14 weeks sounds absolutely incredible. In fact, it sounds to the point where if this were continuing, if this were the sort of a trend that was developing out of this, I would suggest that would be something that would not be easily hideable, or not something that could be covered up very easily, especially because one would assume that in the immediate vicinity of Fukushima, there would be a much, much higher death toll. One would assume it would only be logical. But I haven't seen anything similar to that type of study going on in Japan. And that's not to say, again, that those types of studies aren't going on or those types of results won't be found. But I'm just saying that until we see other sources on this, I'm going to be a little bit skeptical of that number at any rate. It sounds like a number that is sort of plucked out of the statistics, and I wouldn't be willing to put my faith in that. Certainly, is there cause for concern to people on the western coast of the United States? I would certainly say so, but the extent to which people should be waiting to die, basically, because of this disaster, I'm still not convinced of that. And I think, again, ultimately for me in Japan, it's not the fallout that I'm as concerned about as the food supply, because I think that's a direct way in which the radiation is getting into bioaccumulating in the food chain. In terms of the fallout, I find it really hard to believe that. If it's true, and I'm not saying it's not, but if it's true, that should be the immediate end of the nuclear industry as we know it, and it should happen overnight. But I'm waiting for this to be corroborated, I guess, by other studies.
That's right. What are you doing about the food issue, and what precautions can you take over there? Well, what's the alternatives? Are you seeing an increase in imported goods? But again, as you say, the area you're in might not be as affected, so you might still be in a kind of an okay zone, if you will.
Well, that's right. Certainly, we've been trying to source as many fresh produce and vegetables and things of that nature as locally as we can, preferably in the prefecture that we're living in, just to try to minimize anything coming from eastern northern Japan. And it is actually somewhat difficult to do. So many of the foods sourced from Hokkaido, the northern island of Japan, which I'm really hesitant to get anything from that area of the country, because, again, that's really was affected much more by the fallout than our area of Japan. So I have been very careful about sourcing that and trying to source foreign foods when possible. But it's actually quite difficult here, and so many of the foods are just processed and come from Japanese companies that are based in Tokyo, and who knows where they're manufactured or what ingredients they're sourcing from. So it can be extremely difficult to parse where things are ultimately coming from. But for myself personally, I'm trying to source as many things locally as possible, and going to local vegetable markets and things like that.
Now, I don't know if you eat fish. I don't know how we could avoid it over in Japan, but what about the oceans? What about the fish? What have you heard, and how dangerous do you think it is to eat the fish?
Well, that's absolutely the key for me. I can't, other than the occasional shrimp or something, I can't remember eating very much seafood at all since the disaster occurred, and I'm very much against the idea of doing so unless I know precisely where the fish is coming from. Because when you look at the fallout maps, if you will, in the ocean itself and where the ocean currents have been projected to have taken, the incredible amounts of radiation that have been pouring into the ocean for the last several months, when you look at those maps, they're really quite startling, quite horrifying. And it got to the point where there were some a few months ago, there was a story about some fishermen in Fukushima, the Fukushima area, who had been okayed by the government to actually continue fishing and selling their fish, because supposedly the government had tested at least some of their fish and declared it to be within the acceptable limits, which, by the way, were raised in the event of the disaster. But the fishermen themselves decided to stop selling their fish because they said they didn't want to contribute to the deaths of anyone, because they just knew that it had been much more more affected from the radiation than the government was letting on. So that was a pretty startling story for me. So certainly seafood is my number one concern and one of the things that I'm most hesitant about. And then in the immediate wake of the fallout, the leafy vegetables and things of that sort were the main concern, because that's where the fallout was settling. And of course, later on in the season, it becomes the root vegetables that become more of the problem. So I've been thinking about those types of things, but it's extremely difficult when you really end up having to try to source all of the food from and know where everything came from, which highlights, I think, one of the fundamental problems of the Western world in general these days, which is just trying to source where your food is coming from unless you grow it yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a problem worldwide in that sense. This is just a more direct example. We have on top of this, of course, the issue of the drinking water as well. I remember back in November, we had this story of the Japanese MP was kind of forced, I guess, he wants us to drink the water. What have you followed that story? What happened? What was that about?
I was covering it at the time. I haven't heard of any follow up about him specifically, but I did see that story certainly, and he had sort of backed himself into a corner where he said he'd be willing to drink the water. So they took some groundwater, which I believe was from directly underneath the plant, and they boiled it to decontaminate it, and then they served it to him, and he drank it with a rather shaky grasp, as some of the reporters who were there wrote about it. But I haven't heard any follow-up about it, and who knows to what extent that was even a staged thing, because who knows if it was truly he was drinking that water, whether they were just saying it for the photo opportunity. But at any rate, that was the way it went down, and it was supposed to instill confidence in the public about the water in the area.
Obama.
Confidence in myself, anyway.
Kind of like Obama swimming in the that little protected pool in the Florida coast there. Remember
right,
that story?
Right, yes. And therefore the everything thing. Is okay.
Yeah. Ridiculous. But, I mean, in regard, it's a horrendous disaster, or again, whatever we want to, whatever name we want to put on this. But unfortunately, the damage is done. If we look forward, James, if we look ahead, what are you hearing right now when it comes to the fixes? I mean, again, we hear that the nuclear site has been stabilized. Everything is good. Next day, it's, oh my God, everything is wide open. It's meltdown and nuclear fuel is just leaking out into the atmosphere. What are we? What's happening?
Well, that's a great question, and that really is the $64,000 question. If we could answer that, I think we'd have some answers about the situation in general. But again, it really does depend what sources you're looking at. And of course, the government right now is saying that the situation has been stabilized. They're calling it cold shutdown, even though it's not technically cold shutdown, and all of those tricks that they're playing, I think they're pretty transparent, playing with the semantics of the thing and all of that. As you say, we keep getting reports not only of raised radiation levels in certain areas. Reports out today from Minami-Soma near Fukushima, a city that's reporting 41.72 microsieverts, which is much above usual rates. We have debris now, of course, washing up not only in the United States, but continuing to wash up on the shores of Fukushima Prefecture, and some concrete debris that was washing up just on Christmas Day, actually, was containing 3,000 becquerels per kilogram, which is quite a high rate of radiation. So again, we keep seeing these stories that individually, not any one of them is going to be the one that I think will cause people to panic. But overall, it doesn't seem that these types of stories are really going down in volume, or they don't. It's difficult to tell because, of course, we only get them in bite-sized pieces. So unless there is a concerted attempt by people with the resources to do so, and I suppose we'd be looking at the mainstream media to do that, to collate this information and to put it into a perspective, then I don't think we really can understand the extent that the situation is. And it, one of the things that struck me in the immediate wake of this disaster was I was going back and watching documentaries on the Chernobyl disaster, and it really struck me just how little the public knew at that time about what was going on at the plant itself and what the people were doing and why they were doing it and what their concerns were. And they were quite different, I imagine, from what the public was being told. And it really paints, I mean, once you go back and you look at the footage that they were taking of their operations in Chernobyl and all of the things that they were doing behind the scenes, it really paints the picture of the discrepancy between what was going on at the plant and what people were being told. So we can try to look at these types of stories that leak out one by one and these isolated reports of radiation here and radiation there, but I don't think we have any clue really, and we won't until probably decades hence when they finally open up the vaults on this type of information. So that's the travesty, and really the question then becomes, what can we do about it on our level? And again, that's a question that I think is above my pay grade. I don't know if there is an easy pat response to that, other than that obviously people should be highly distrustful of the information that's coming out from official sources and trying to, I guess, put this into context for themselves. And that's really why I started Fukushima Update and have been trying to follow this since the beginning, because really it's such a large story and it develops from day to day that unless you are following it, I think it's easy to get lost in just the occasional headline or two, and then it becomes a question of out of sight, out of mind. And unfortunately, to a large extent, this entire disaster has sort of gone under the radar now, because there are just other news stories that have come along to fill the news cycle.
Well, that's a really good point. Okay, granted, back in 1986, Chernobyl, it was in a closed-off region of communist Soviet Union, obviously. But at the same time, I remember that it was actually a Swedish nuclear power plant that first reported the increased levels. And it wasn't until this was being reported, if you will, to the international scene that the Soviet Union actually bothered to officially declare that there had been an accident. But today it's kind of...
Exactly right.
And today it's kind of the opposite in a way, James. We're being bathed in stories, if you will, and the media is exploding with this. And the question is, I mean, are we better off? I mean, obviously more information is better, I understand that, but at the same time it's like we're still trying to struggle to find the balance in between where we just simply could get accurate reporting instead of either too little or way too much, you know what I mean?
Exactly right. And I think there's obviously quite a big discrepancy between what's going on in the Japanese media and what's been going on in the Western media. And unfortunately, my Japanese is not good enough to really follow the Japanese print media or news media directly. I can only do it through translation. So I'm relying on certain sites that people will see me linking to from Fukushima Update quite often to translate some of the stories. But there are some newspapers that are doing what looks to be quite incredible reporting and putting together really in-depth, detailed series about what's going on and trying to draw out the story and really do the type of reporting that we should be seeing going on in the international media. And that's really what I want to see going on. And I don't care if it comes from a mainstream source or an alternative source, just as long as someone is doing it and sort of citing the information and where it's coming from and what kind of investigations they were doing.
Yep.
But again, we just haven't seen that happening in the English media to the extent that I think it really needs to, because obviously this is an international story, just like Chernobyl was an international story that really did start to break, as you say, when it was detected at that Swedish nuclear plant. And when we think about that disaster and what came of it, I mean, that was part of the entire glasnost and perestroika and the opening up of the Soviet Union in a lot of ways. And of course, the UN inspectors were famously let in to take a look at Chernobyl a few months into the process. So that was part of a really tectonic shift in the development of the end days, I suppose, of the Soviet Union. So again, this does have the power to be quite a transformative event in Japanese society, but I haven't really seen any indications that it's going to be yet.
Chernobyl is obviously a deserted ghost town today with some things just lying abandoned. There's been a number of reports about this, and I'm sure you potentially saw some of this in the documentaries you've watched about this as well. But to what extent do you think that this will happen in Japan around the Fukushima Daiichi, what is it, province, they call it, right? Will this
prefecture,
be prefecture, there you go, thank you. Will this be left empty in the same way? What do you expect to happen here?
Well, as far as I know, they're already starting to let people back into the evacuation zone, and part of the entire con that's going on right now is the decontamination, and I put the stress on con, because if you actually take a look at some of the methods that they're purporting to use to purportedly decontaminate the areas, they're really farcical. They're almost satirical that anyone expects this to be taken seriously, but it really does amount to people with power washers and putting some tarp down on the ground and washing the trees, washing the houses. And even the government's own reports have admitted in the newspapers, in the mainstream media, have admitted, oh, well, we tried to decontaminate these 24 example houses, and we only got a few of them down to the actual range that we were looking for. But they're continuing to press ahead with these types of really ridiculous measures by people who aren't qualified to do so. They're hiring basically power washing companies to come along and do this decontamination work. So it becomes just this type of parody. But I think this tends to be more of a psychological operation to convince people that something is being done rather than something that's actually going to do something. Because as one Japanese government official put it a few months ago, the idea of decontamination of the area is really quite preposterous, because other than scraping up the top level of soil of the entire prefecture and transporting it somewhere else, there's really no way to decontaminate the region itself. No. And even if you were to scrape up the top level of soil, where would you put it? I mean, it would just contaminate another area. So the problem of the decontamination is one that's not going to go away. And for the people in that area, I just my heart goes out to them, because they are truly have been the victims of not only of the initial disaster, but then of the ongoing disaster and the future ramifications. Because I think what should have been done is what was done in the Chernobyl event of the evacuation of the area and really, as you say, the ghost town that area turned into. And in this situation, as I see it, I think they're going to start trying to say that everything outside of the maybe a 10-kilometer zone is going to be habitable again. So it's quite a tragic turn of events, I think, for the people of the region.
There was a really, really good documentary released a while back called Into Eternity, and it was actually about a Finnish nuclear power plant. The documentary went into the aspect of how, you know, the incredible extent and then the financial task it was to actually make sure that the spent fuel was put away responsibly. This was about they were drilling down into the mountains of up in Finland, and I can't remember even how the distances and how deep down they dug actually. I can bring some of this up, but again, the movie was called Into Eternity, and it was just kind of interesting watching this, because this happened for me then a little bit before the accident in Fukushima. And what, this is a difficult question, obviously, but I just want your take on it. What rights or rather responsibilities should other countries, do you think, have when it comes to this? Some countries are spending millions, if not billions of their own currencies into making sure that the spent fuel is being taken care of in a responsible way, while others seem to just dump it under their own plants in some cases. But the consequence, that's what I'm trying to get to here, obviously is a global phenomenon, as we've seen here. This is now the fuel is being burst out into the upper atmosphere and then consequently rained down onto other countries. So the question is, who has the responsibility here, and what rights do you think other countries should be able to have as well to actually go into Japan in this case and actually either try to help them out or almost forcibly, try to prevent this from actually continuing the disaster to just unfold further? It's a very difficult question, I know, but what's your take on that overall?
Well, it's a difficult question, but it's an extremely important one, and I think it teases out the very important overall part of the way that this slots into a possible overall agenda, as we were talking about before, the way that this can be used to reshape not only Japanese society, but really the global society that they're, as we say, hoping to bring in. And this goes to the heart of that, because as you say, this is a crisis that may be local in origin, but is global in scope. And that's the type of disaster that the globalists quite obviously love to have, because that's one in which they get to come in as the saviors and meddle with the system that they helped to set up and design and fund and make money off of and all of that that they've been deeply involved with for so long, and then to say, oh, look how terrible this is. The only solution is to have some sort of global authority that looks after this, and everything should be processed through this global authority, and then it should handle all of the problems that arise. And of course, that's the creation of the global governmental systems that create a global government by default. And that's the type of path that I think this type of disaster can be used to lead us down. And as you say, it's an important question, but all of these questions surrounding this tend to play into the existing reality of the nuclear industry as it is right now and as it's been developed. But as we noted earlier, the entire nuclear industry is developed around uranium and the uranium enrichment because the uranium could be used as fissile material for nuclear weapons. And it was that hand-in-glove nuclear power, nuclear weapons development of the nuclear industry that made this into the type of problem it is today. And although the technology exists and is coming online to create much, much safer reactors with different fuel supplies, with thorium and things of that nature, that is something that's being, in a lot of ways, left out of the debate because we're just taking this the existing uranium supplies as they exist as the prototype, as the model for nuclear power and the way it's supposed to work. So I think one of the intriguing things that I've heard to come out of this debate is the sort of the third way in the debate, not just the nuclear versus anti-nuclear debate, but the third way debate that says, well, the way that we've been doing in implementing nuclear power is wrong. Nuclear power is important because it opens up energy to so many people who otherwise wouldn't have it, and it's as potentially as revolutionary as the development of petroleum resources was to the 19th century. That can be what this will be for the 21st century. But it's being demonized right now because it's a dirty fuel supply, which can then be demonized as a way to again, try to keep the control on the energy resources, which is truly one of the fundamental things that underlies the development of civilization itself. I mean, certainly we see the Industrial Revolution, which was hand in glove with the Petroleum Revolution, which was the thing which has created the society that we have today, for better and for worse, and has enabled so many people like yourself in Sweden to talk to myself in Japan, to talk to the listeners wherever they are in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, the types of technologies that we have that have been enabled because we have this underlying energy infrastructure is truly mind-boggling to think about. So to think of how the people who want the grip on global power can actually demonize the energy production and the energy sources itself in order to maintain their grip on that energy infrastructure, in order to try to keep people suppressed and keep the system within their clutches, I think to me is the interesting part of this. And it does raise the question, well, what if the nuclear industry is trying to be demonized here in order that that there can be the creation of a global regulatory authority or the elimination of nuclear power whatsoever, which, when coupled with the peak oil fraud that they've been trying to perpetrate for mm-hmm. decades now,
yep.
would basically allow them to start to bring in that global control structure, which would be part of getting people attuned and used to the idea that they will have less and less access to the types of energy resources which we have as a society, as a civilization, taken for granted for so many decades now.
Exactly. Very good point. Energy is now being turned into a luxury in that sense. And instead of us moving ahead, looking forward to, as you say, new, clean, better, just simply more efficient technologies, because I'm a believer that there is such technologies. I'm a believer that there is incredible potential in where we could go if we actually had moved on from this point now and stopped using this, what is it, old 50s, 60s technology, as you say, with these old nuclear reactors. After all, we're doing nothing more than boiling water with it. It's incredible when we think about it. And so, I mean, obviously, James, this is a good kind of a segue over to the other issue here that we're going to shift over to in a little while as we continue to talk more about ClimateGate 2.0. Before we leave the topic, though, of Fukushima, we want to give out your website for that, specifically FukushimaUpdate.com. You're doing great work on that site, reporting. Of course, you have your regular one, CorbettReport.com. That's your main site where people can follow your work as well. But let's see here then. Why don't we stick to this topic a little bit here more in terms of the energy question before we take a break, James, and segue over to the ClimateGate issue, segue into the Green Movement and obviously their dark agenda as well, because the debate, from my point of view, has been kind of stifled, if you will, in this sense, and we're not focusing on new technologies, we're not focusing on new possibilities here, we're being limited to moving over to mercury-based light bulbs, pretty much. That's where, in the realm that we're in right now. But how do you see that this the Fukushima disaster, and then tying it into the Green Movement here, that this could potentially be used to actually unlock the area of not only free, you know, energy as it's called, but also just a better update, a new technology. Do you really think sincerely that we could move into this area now when we've seen so much detrimental effects of the things that we've been using that is based on older technology, James?
I not only have no doubt that we could move to much better systems, but I also have no doubt that there have been better technologies that have been developed over the decades that have been suppressed by the not only the industries themselves that obviously serve to benefit financially from keeping such technologies suppressed, but more importantly, I think, by the people who have been behind the funding and financing and founding of those industries, who really know that the control of the energy supply is in so many ways the control of global society as a whole. And that really was a lesson that, at the very least, if it hadn't been learned before, was certainly learned, as I say, with the development of the petroleum revolution in the 19th century. And of course, who do we think of when we think of that in the United States? We think of the Rockefeller dynasty, which was founded on Standard Oil and the monopolization of that industry, that burgeoning industry, which at its inception, at the beginning, when Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, was first getting into that, it was a technology that was, or I suppose a new product that was useful, but not as useful as it has become, because we have now built an entire infrastructure, an entire worldwide global infrastructure on the back of the internal combustion engine, which came up in the wake of that discovery. So at the beginning, it was being used for heating and lamps and things of that sort. But once that technology was harnessed for an entire infrastructure was built around it, it became sort of a glue that held society fastened to the Rockefellers and the other titans who have had their clutch on the control of energy for so long. So it's been such a key and fundamental part of everything that I think it's self-evident that if any technology came up that truly offered to break through that paradigm and offered to develop energy that could be harnessed and used by the public freely, it would be attacked with absolute venom and impunity by the people at the top of the system, because that, to me, is truly the Achilles heel by which they are able to control us. And if they were attacked at that point, and if something were developed and given to the masses, it would undoubtedly change the game that they've been playing with us for centuries, but at the very least demonstrably since the 1870s or so. But to my mind, I have no doubt that such technologies have been developed and have been suppressed and continue to be so. And there are many exciting developments that continue to come up, and who knows to what extent what games are being played, because every few years there are scientists that come along that say that, you know, they've developed this or that technology, and of course they won't demonstrate it openly. They'll only demonstrate it in certain closed conditions, and only when in the attempt to try to sell this technology to investors and things like that. So there are always games being played with this, and I'm sure there are a lot of red herrings that are thrown out by the people at the top to try to get us to latch on to ideas that aren't going to go anywhere, because that also serves their ultimate interests in the long run as well. If we are constantly chasing our tails looking at failed technologies, but the point overall is that anything that truly threatens their system will be attacked with absolute impunity. And unfortunately, I'm sure that we've fallen prey to that as a collective for many decades now.
Well, you're absolutely right. People become disillusioned in that way. I understand that, too. I mean, with broken promises, if you will, of potential technologies that never seem to come out there. There is a frustration. I know that from a personal account as well. Remember hearing about, you know, zero-point devices, what have you, 10 years ago. But nothing seems to be moving in that direction so far, in a way, as far as we know. And few people are really, really outspoken to show and openly demonstrate this. And then the question here, obviously, is what could move us in this direction. Some people argued a open source type of approach to this, where you would release the blueprint, if you will, of a technology like this to a mass of people, which would basically prevent them from cracking down into one little unique individual that has developed this, but actually you disperse it across the grid, if you will, in that sense. And that's a potential promise. But your point is absolutely well taken in the fact that this is about energy equals freedom, basically, and what they're cracking down on is freedom. And that's why they want us to be dependent on whatever system that they create for us. They don't care if we move backward into the Middle Ages and back into a feudal system again. They ferociously are going to fight against something that would enable people to free themselves from the dependency that they've set up for us. So really good point on that. But
It's not just that they don't care if we move back into that type of feudal society. I mean, they demonstrably and in their writings repeatedly say that they want the post-industrial society. They want to bring us back to a society where we are dependent on. So it is part of, I think, the overall agenda to keep us in that energy-dependent state, whereby we are constantly basically just relying on the goodwill of the people at the top to give us the scraps and, that we need in order to get by on a day-to-day basis. And that's going to look different in the 21st century than it did in the 12th century, but it's going to have, I think, ultimately the same effect if we allow them to develop that system. And just one example of that that type of society and how it really is closer than any of us would like to, or many of us would like to believe, it came in November of 2009 when the head of the UK Environment Agency, Lord Smith of Finsbury, came out and said that he was arguing that that people should be given individual carbon allowances, and it would be kept on a carbon ration card that that kept track of your carbon account, and you were allotted a certain amount of carbon to be used each month or each year. Yeah. And when you hit zero, you would have to then pay in order to buy more carbon allowances. And that, I mean, that's an example of the system that they want to put us on to eventually take us to the point where we are basically groveling and begging to try to get energy to do anything. And that was a serious proposal that was made by the head of the UK Environment Agency in 2009. And in November 2009, of course, as we're about to talk about, of course, very key, because that was the exact time of the release of the ClimateGate documents, which really did change that argument in so many fundamental ways. So people are fighting back and people are educating themselves about what's really going on, but it's a question of whether they're setting up the infrastructure in order to trap us and whether it will actually take effect before enough people can become informed about these issues.
And the idea there about the carbon credits, if you will, If anyone out there want to have a kind of a visual representation, in one sense, symbolically, of what this might mean, actually go and check out the Hollywood movie called In Time, and you'll get an idea in that sense of what James is talking about here. That's in regards to time, but you can just traverse that over to carbon, actually, instead. It doesn't matter, but this basically shows this idea as well, that you are being limited in terms of whatever means that they have chosen, that you are, you know, making your transaction with, no matter if it's seconds or carbon units or what have you. But it's just incredible, the audacity. But we're going to get into this more, obviously, in the next segment here, James. Again, I want to give out the website before we do so, CorbettReport.com, and then what we've been primarily talking about here. People can find more information about all of this on Fukushima Update. .com, and then we're going to move into your other website that you have set up as well, called ClimateGate.tv. Before we do that as well, though, James, tell us about some of the DVDs and so forth you have out there. You released a new one since we had you with us last time, I think, on the program.
That's right. So I have the 2009 Video Archive DVD, which is a straightforward video DVD that you can play in any video DVD player or on your computer, that contains some of the best reports from my 2009 video work. And that includes, for example, an interview with Dr. Tim Ball in Canada about the ClimateGate scandal before it actually happened. I was lucky enough to interview him about that and about the IPCC. It contains other reports and interviews that I did during 2009, but as you say, I just released a new DVD. It's the data DVD archive. It's actually a data DVD that you play on your computer, but it contains every single video, every interview, every podcast episode, every article that I wrote or recorded or published from the founding of the Corbett Report in 2007 until the end of 2008. So it's over 6 gigabytes of data, quite a huge amount of information. But I think it's important, not only does it obviously support my work when people buy that, but I think it's important to get these types of this data onto physical devices that we can move around and on hard copies, because as I see it, really we are moving closer and closer towards the absolute crackdown on the internet as we've known it, and who knows to what extent sites like the Corbett Report will be around in the future. So I hope it's a valuable thing to get this information out in an actual hard form that people can take around with them, and they'll never be able to erase that from the internet. They can try what they like, but I think we have to be moving more towards low tech, even as we embrace the high tech to try to reach into the matrix to grasp people to get them out of there.
Well, exactly. The latest thing on the table, I guess you should say it right now, is SOPA or Protect IP. There's a number of these really, really nefarious things out there, and maybe we get a chance to address some of these a little bit later. But in the meantime, obviously, then head on over to CorbettReport.com. There you can take a look at his podcasts, his audios and videos, and of course support James' work, and do pick up copies of his DVDs and furthermore then the latest Data DVD that he just mentioned from 2007 to 2008 is up on the website right there on CorbettReport.com as well. Okay, James, let's take a short little break here, then we'll carry on with ClimateGate 2.0 in the next segment, so stay with us. We'll be right back. In the second hour coming up with James Corbett, we begin to discuss the upcoming 2012 Earth Summit in Rio. 20 years later, the elite are returning to the place where so much was spawned, Agenda 21 being one of these. We'll talk about what new tactics are on the horizon for the global warming advocates. James reminds us about the Climatic Research Unit email controversy, also known as ClimateGate scandal, that unfolded in 2009. And now, recently, in November of 2011, a number of new emails have been released. This is from the original batch of ClimateGate emails that first was held back. We discuss the manipulation of science, emotionally driven campaigns, and the pursuit of more control under the guise of sustainability. We end the hour talking about World War III, as the War on Consciousness, a system crashed by design and the time of destabilization, which can be both positive and negative. This and much more is coming up in Hour 2. Don't miss it. Go to redicecreations.com and log in if you're a member, or click subscribe to download or stream this or any of our previous programs. It's simple and it's easy. More information is on the website. Also, check out our new RSS feeds so that you can access both hours easily if you're a member. Next up on Red Eyes Radio, we have Shannon Dory on the Dogon and the Pneumo, Colin Andrews on government circles, crop circle research, and what might be facing us in 2012. Anthony Peake on out-of-body experiences, Mac Maloney on UFOs in wartime, Troy McLaughlin on the Saturn death cult. We also have Carl Munk, Jeff Hilling, Bob Frisell, and Aquaria S. following these programs. You're welcome to tune in again when we're back with more in just a few days, but right now, coming out, Climate Gate 2.0 with James Corbett.